She was born 1939 in Melbourne, Australia, and she's an academic, feminist, and writer of about 20 books. In 1959, she moved to Sydney, where she got involved with an anarchist group called PUSH. And I think from some of her quotes that we'll like to discuss later, I think you can detect her anarchist leanings. So in Australia, she started writing for Oz magazine, which was shut down, by the way, in 1963 for obscenity. She also wrote for Private Eye. She mainly wrote about sex and sexual liberation for women, free love, etc. In 1964, she moved to the UK and she enrolled in Newham's Women's College. The book, The Female Eunuch, was published in 1970, and this is what made her a household name. And I quote from a review of the book, "The Female Eunuch was a rallying cry against housewifery and the service of men." So in an interview with Screw magazine in 1971, she said that there was a big cleft between sexual liberation and women's liberation. Now, anybody can find out facts about her from Wikipedia or wherever. We're not really interested in her so much as what she said. So what I thought we might do is I will give you some quotes of what things that she said, and we can discuss them. So I'm going to start with the first quote, and it's from The Whole Woman, which was published in 1999. "The aim of women's liberation is to do as much for female people as has been done for colonized nations. Women's liberation did not see the female potential in the male's actual. The visionary feminists of the late 60s and early 70s knew that women could never find freedom by agreeing to live the lives of unfree men." So just thought we could discuss those as we go along. Does anyone want to come in on that? I mean, I can give you kind of more controversial ones.
Can I just say that seems to be a call which is very much in line with way we would see things, that even if women are on the same level as men, as it were, they'll still be unfree. What we mean by unfree is one thing. I'm not sure if Germaine Greer would have meant the same thing, but I mean, that's something we could presumably sort of understand and appreciate.
Yeah. I'll give you one more on that same theme. "Women's liberation, if it abolishes the patriarchal family, will abolish a necessary substructure of the authoritarian state. And once that withers away, Marx will have come true willy-nilly, so let's get on with it."
Unless, of course, what she's looking at is a non-authoritarian state. Can't be sure about that.
No.
Or we need a wider context.
Yeah. What do you mean non-authoritarian? How can you have a non-authoritarian state?
Look, those states are more or less authoritarian, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yes, we would say all states are authoritarian, but would probably say, unless you were, and he's not with us this afternoon, Tim would sort of disagree with this. The party would say that this country, for example, was a less authoritarian state than, say, China or North Korea, to give an extreme example.
Right. So.
Yeah, I was sort of looking at some of the things that she said, and she did seem to be more interested in a kind of more universal liberation than certainly not. She wasn't one of those feminists who just, I think she said something about she didn't want to an invitation into the world of coronary and heart disease. So she wasn't interested in equality with men as they, you know, as they currently are. But I didn't get any sense that she was very clear about what this liberation involved.
Well, she did say, and that's on this subject entirely, I didn't fight to get women out from behind the vacuum cleaners to get them on the board of Hoover. So I guess that's kind of, you know, she didn't want the status quo. She didn't want to keep the status quo. She also said, the high-heeled shoe is a marvellously contradictory item. It brings a woman to a man's height, but makes sure she cannot keep up with him. How about that one?
That's quite good.
She was very critical of other women, and in fact, that's one of the not so good, nice things about her. I don't think she had this sense of sisterhood. She was very scathing about certain women and certain women in the public eye.
Yeah, she actually says at one point that she doesn't like women, I think, doesn't she?
Well, she did, but she also said that women have no idea about how much men hate them. So I'm not so, you know, generalising there, I guess, but... Okay, how about this one? The most powerful entities on Earth are not governments, but the multinational corporations that see women as their territory, indoctrinating them with their version of beauty, health and hygiene, medicating them and cultivating their dependency in order to medicate them some more. And that's from The Whole Woman. What do we think of that?
She says that multinational companies are more oppressive than state governments. Is that what you said?
Yeah, she's saying the most powerful entities on Earth are not governments, but multinational corporations. But they run government, don't they? That's what she said.
Mm.
Do we agree with that, not agree with that?
No, we don't agree with that, no. They don't run government. Governments run the system on their behalf. That's a different thing.
Right. Well, is it a different thing or is it the same thing?
Well, not the same thing, because different multinational companies may have and do have sort of different goals and different priorities and so on. And what governments have to do, or a particular government has to do, say, in a given country, is sort of, you know, mediate between them or govern in such a way that that attempts to sort of, you know, keep them all happy, as it were, or decide to keep some happy and not others. I suppose what I'm trying to say, it's not as simple as Germaine Greer is suggesting there.
It depends what you mean by power, doesn't it? I mean, you know, governments are kind of, you know, political drivers in a sense. Corporations are cultural drivers with the aim of selling, and they shape and direct popular culture to that end, which is not something that governments are particularly interested in doing, I would have thought. So if you're talking about cultural power, which is, you know, arguably what patriarchy is in a sense, you know, perhaps you could argue that corporations are more powerful in that sense than governments.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, go on.
I just said one for Germaine Greer then, if that's what she means.
No, I'm no lover of Germaine Greer. At the end of Female Eunuch, she writes, privileged women will pluck at your sleeve and seek to enlist you in the fight for reforms. But reforms are retrogressive. The old process must be broken, not made new. Bitter women will call you to rebellion, but you have too much to do. What will you do? So I think she recognises, you know, faults in the system.
Yeah, she also seems to be saying there that kind of feminism of the time, what was it, second wave feminism, was a sort of quite bourgeois affair. Is that what she's saying?
I think so. I mean, it's a bit difficult just because, I mean, you know, I've not read all her work and I've read a couple of books of hers and I only know what's been said about her, same as anyone else. But, yeah, it is. I'm not quite sure. What will you do? What she means about that. What will you do? But you have too much to do.
I wonder whether you're going to use the quotation, which is actually on my screen, the blurb for this talk, which says, despite of a widespread feeling of complacency, that one?
Yeah.
Can I read it out and perhaps...
Yes, I've got it. Yeah, it's in front of me anyway. Yeah, go on.
Well, she says, in spite of a widespread feeling of complacency that suggests that the woman question is answered and the battle is won, what started in the 60s as a movement for liberation has been sidetracked. What women have been duped into settling for is a spurious version of equality. It was in 1999. Well, what do you think she means by that? Spurious version of equality, I mean.
I think she means that women or people think we have equality because we now have women in men's jobs. We have now highly paid women. I mean, we still talk about the invisible ceiling. But I just think she means that we haven't really. Women have to fight. It would appear that women have to fight all the time. Not just for equality, I mean, freedom, but to maintain any freedoms or anything that they've already achieved. You know, it's like we're hanging on to, we're still hanging on to things. You know, we're still hanging on to what it means to be a woman, the definition of woman. You know, she's gender critical, and a lot of the transgender lobby, have actually no platformed her. They hate her. Because she questions. I'll look for a quote here. But I think she thinks that there is that they haven't got. We haven't got very far. I don't know. Anyone else having an idea on that? I mean, does anyone here think that women have achieved equality?
I don't think anyone here thinks that men have achieved equality. Anyone's achieved equality. The working class haven't.
No, not... Right, OK, but women, equality with men. Or... Yeah. I mean, we haven't even reached that, have we? As women?
No, I think... I can see what... I agree with the idea that, yeah, that, about spurious equality. It's a sort of... cosmetic equality, but underneath it's not at all.
I don't want to challenge it. Man is powerful, is go-getting, is ambitious. Women are strident, are ball breakers. So the vocabulary is just so anti women.
Joy, could you just come a bit closer to the microphone because we're not picking you up.
Saying, Paddy, was it's just I'm thinking of the vocabulary which is used, where a man can be powerful, ambitious, successful, outspoken, etc., and these things are considered to be virtues. I mean, get labelled as strident, ball breakers, difficult women. You don't often hear about difficult men, as evidenced by the book that we've just read on Radio 4's Book of the Week, entitled Difficult Women. I don't think I can remember a book, the title Difficult Men.
It was a deliberately ironic title.
Deliberately ironic, yes, but nevertheless true. That's how they're viewed.
If I could come in that, I suppose the issue there is that whether or not women should sort of adapt their sort of behaviour and their attitude to fit into structures and systems which have traditionally been male dominated and therefore attracted sort of masculine or aggressive traits in order to succeed in those environments. So I suppose that the question is there is should women be expected to become like men or become masculine or adopt masculine traits, maybe I should say, or if structures themselves should be adapted in order to in order that sort of masculine associated traits like aggression or being outspoken should be changed. I suppose the question there is within that particular conversation as to whether or not women should change or should the culture of the upper echelons of companies change. I'm not quite sure what Jermaine Greer's views on that are, but that seems to be sort of where the conversation is placed. And I suppose on that, you know, there's a sort of reformist angle to that, isn't there? In that, you know, reform the culture of companies or structures in order to make them more accessible to women. But, you know, we would say that doesn't go far enough. You know, the whole structure rather than just the culture of organisations should change. So I don't know. Maybe that's sort of the territory of the of that particular conversation.
Yeah, I think she was she wasn't interested in like some feminists that she criticised. She wasn't interested in a bigger slice of the pie. You know, she wanted it. She wanted it to not there not to be that pie or it to be different. So she wasn't interested in being around. And she was an incredible strident. I mean, she certainly wasn't considered what is considered feminine. And she writes a lot about what is considered feminine and femininity. You know, the subservient woman. And there's a quote here that I was, if I can find it. Oh, okay, so this was something that she wrote concerning rape, and it says, historically, the crime of rape was committed not against the woman, but against the man with an interest in her, i.e. her father or husband. So this still exists. I mean, I'm not saying that it might exist in Western societies that much, but it still exists in this world, that women are still the property of the male member of their family.
Is it the case, would you say, Paula, that broadly speaking, the whole of her thought process is sort of geared to a framework in which we live, capitalist framework, even though it's often regarded as a radical and possibly even at the beginning an anarchist? Is there any evidence that she's able to see beyond the confines of society we live in?
I don't think so. I think that she may well have a vision of a different society. But, of course, you know, women have to live in this society. We're not going to wait. What are we going to do? Are we going to be bashed? Are we going to be murdered? Are we going to be downtrodden until we get socialism? I guess she fought against that.
And what's she fighting for now, if anything? Do we know?
Oh, she's staying quiet now. She's been no platform so many times. I think she's kind of, well, she's 81, so she's kind of quietened down. I don't think she would have changed her views, but she doesn't express them the way she used to.
Well, I think the sort of more dominant strands of the feminist movement have gone in a different direction to that which she was one of she was more prominent in sort of second wave feminism, and of course now these days the argument has shifted more towards focus on gender and transgender issues, and that's where she, or one, that and the, her views on how rape is treated by the criminal justice system. Yeah, so the conversation's moved in a different direction to one which she has sort of established herself in. So yeah, she's not as prominent now as she used to be, and you know, many feminists don't have time for her at all. So yeah, in that sense, the argument has moved on in a different direction to her own arguments.
No, I was just saying, I think Mike's right, that what she did in 1970 with the publication of the female unit was break new ground then. She has been superseded. But as it, in its day, an impressionable 18-year-old, it really was eye-opening, and it was a life-changer.
I think a lot of women would say that too, Joy. It is a life-changer.
I shaved my legs, though.
Yeah, she probably did too. I
think she didn't.
Well, she
there was a whole chapter in the female eunuch, I remember, on hair, on body hair.
Yeah, there was.
I was 18, Italian, and very hairy and dark. Made a big impression on me, and I thought, well, I agree with a lot of it, but I'm going to skip that chapter.
Well, surely the point on issues like body hair, it's allowing women the choice, isn't it, and not to feel compelled in one direction or the other as to whether or not that's something that they want to make a decision on. So yeah, I'm guessing the important thing is choice rather than succumbing either to to sort of stereotypes of what. You know, what women should, in inverted commas, do. So, yeah, surely the important thing there is choice rather than, being compelled to do anything in particular in whatever way.
I think that, yeah, very true. But I think the point at the time maybe was not it was a choice as a woman, whether you were the chair. It was what men expected you to be. That was the problem. And I think that, to a certain extent, still applies. Women are still trying to conform, not to what they would like to be in themselves, but what they think a man. It's a sort of von Ruskin syndrome, of women need to appear to be young, virginal, prepubescent if possible. That's the sort of image that we have. It's a lot of young women, especially, are aspiring to. I don't know if anybody heard. Young woman who's written a book recently, she was on Woman's Hour last week. A fantastic book, sort of new wave feminism, which I can neither remember what she was called nor what the name of the book was, but she was expanding on various topics like this, and it really was refreshing. This day and age of Instagram and likes and dislikes and how you're supposed to look, she was really criticising and trying to encourage women not to have to succumb to this sort of pressure.
So in that case, Joy, it's almost as if the women's liberation has not got very far. We're still suffering these things. These things are still going on. And in fact, like you said, with Instagram and stuff like this, it seems to be even worse for young women.
I think you're absolutely right, Carla. I mean, a few years ago, I did the supply teaching at a secondary school here. And at the end of the year, they had their prom. Now, I wasn't familiar with this sort of thing because it certainly wasn't something we did in my day. And the amount of money that was spent on the fake tan, the nails, the hair, the dress, it was absolutely staggering. I couldn't believe it. It was all about having the perfect image.
Yeah, and I think that a dangerous side of that, flip side of that is that a lot of it's a phenomenon now. That a lot of young pubescent girls obviously are actually deciding that they don't want to be girls, that they want to be boys.
Yeah, good point.
And I think that because of my opinion would be because of the pressure, they don't feel that they are girly enough, that they're feminine enough. So if they're not feminine enough, then it must be the fact that they must be boys then. It's an easier life being a boy.
That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of it in that way.
There is the fact, though, that I mean, my son, he's just coming up to 17, and a lot of his friends, probably most of his friends of his age, male friends, go to the gym. Now, when I was his age, I didn't know anybody who went to the gym. It was unheard of. We ran around the school playground, played a bit of football after school. That was about it. We never occurred to any of us that we needed to get fit, or as my son's friends call it, getting in shape. And so going back to my earlier point about how corporations might be the driver of cultural change in order to make money, what seems to be happening is that the pressure hasn't come off women at all. But if anything, it's intensified. But it's also now being applied to young men, so that they're now being forced, they're being pressurized to buy the right products and have the right photoshopped looking body, even at my son's age, at 17. And I talked to, he wanted to go to a gym as well, because he felt like it's what he should do. And, you know, I had a long discussion with him about how this was manipulation by the corporations. This was all capitalism trying to get under their skin at a young age and make them feel like there was something wrong with them. They needed to do all this work. And I just found it's such a shame that this is what capitalism's doing. It's not making anything easier for women. It's just applying the same sorts of ridiculous pressures to men.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It seems to be an amplification of what is considered feminine and what is considered masculine. You're not a man unless you've got a six-pack, and you're not a woman unless you've got, you know, an 18-inch waist and big boobs or something. And there are these pressures absolutely on both sexes. And also, I'm quite worried about the type of pornography that young boys are exposed to these days, very young boys that can get online. And, you know, they're exposed to women being mistreated, but women that are hairless, women that basically enjoy anything that a man wants to do to them. And I won't go into the details, obviously. And I think in reality, when they see a real girl, that's not what turns them on anymore. They're turned on by this kind of corporate-made image of what a female will look like. And so young boys are now growing up with a totally imaginary and false image of what women do look like and what turns them on sexually. It's very disturbing.
I agree that sort of drive has sort of accelerated over the last few years, you know, due to the increase in social media and photo manipulation and as Paddy's said, yeah, in some ways that there are more pressures on men which that there haven't been, and you know, still ongoing pressures on women, and I think that the pressures on women are still more stressful and have more negative consequences. I think, and funny enough, this ties in with what I'll be talking about in summer school. It's a sort of a drive to be artificial, almost, in the Well, there's always been that, of course. You know, makeup, for example, has been around for thousands of years. And you could say that's a, you know, an attempt to become sort of artificial in some sense of the word. But I think that those sort of drives are accelerating. But yeah, women still suffer from those more so than men. But yeah, as Paddy says, it's catching up a bit. And yeah, you know, this kind of culture, it benefits no one, you know, because it creates problems in relationships, and you know, relationships, obviously that's a two-way thing. I mean, funnily enough, I sort of, believe it or not, I regularly attend a gym. And of course, you know, you inevitably do a bit of people watching at those, and there seem to be more men there who go for the, you know, the sort of the the sort of super toned body image, more so than women there. But yeah, I suppose it's sort of straying away from the point of today's discussion a bit. But yeah, I suppose my point was just really to echo what Paddy was saying about pressures increasing for both men and women.
Capitalism is always looking for the next thing to commodify, isn't it, basically?
So, back to Germaine Greer, in criticised in recent times, I think you were saying, Carla, her attitude to the trans agenda.
Yep.
I wonder why. I mean, if we sort of link this to what Joy was saying a few minutes ago about women who, well, girls who don't want to take on board all the sort of pressures that are put on them, prefer to be like boys. You said that, Carla. Yeah, Joy.
Yeah.
That, Carla. Sorry. I mean, is it the case that Germaine Greer's sort of opposition to the trans agenda has got something to do with that?
Okay, I'll read you a couple of In The Whole Woman, she argues that while sex is a biological given, gender roles are cultural constructs. We know that. We know this. But this has brought her into conflict with the transgender community. She also said that governments that consist of very few women have hurried to recognise as women men who believe that they are women and have had themselves castrated to prove it, because they see women not as another sex, but as a non-sex. So what she's been saying all along is that why do men think that they can be women? You know, why do they? Because we don't matter, because we're a non-sex. They can do whatever they want to be. And if they say they're a woman, well, then they must be a woman. She was very, very upset about that.
Yeah, she's got this idea, isn't she? She says somewhere else, I think, that real women are being phased out. The first step, persuading them to deny their own existence, is almost complete.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know how fair is it to suppose that the definition of woman, the very identity of woman, is being phased out. I mean, how does that feel? I mean, from my obviously male perspective, that seems, you know, possibly like a bit of paranoia. But considering all of the other things that are being done, I don't know.
So women were putting up a banner which had the dictionary definition of woman. Woman, adult, human, female. That was considered hate speech. Work that one out. That was considered hate speech.
Well, by whom?
By the transgender lobby, by lots of people, by councils, by universities that were no platforming women that were saying these things. You know, it's a very real issue.
So I don't know if this is just sort of reframing it in different words, but you know, you could say that, especially in the first, you know, two thirds or so of the 20th century and before, women were compelled to fit in with a male idea of what femininity was. But now it's still femininity or women being defined by an outside group. Not sure if that's what it's about. The argument for the last, you know, 100 or so years has been, you know, women being defined by a different group, whereas that other group has now changed slightly, or there's, you know, it's a bit different. You know, it's not sort of men defining women. It's the transgender lobby defining women. Is that what the debate's about? Is that a way of putting it?
Yeah, and Germaine would consider the transgenders mainly men. the men that are involved, not necessarily transgender men, women, sorry, I'm getting confused here, not necessarily transgender women, but some of those, and those that support them, which are mainly men. So it's like men still defining what a woman is and what she can be. And they can be women too. Because women are not that important. So I guess we, you know, as Jermaine says, that we have we got very far?
I wanted to just say something that sounds quite sort of banal, but we were watching TV the other night and an advert came on for something and suddenly it goes from soft focus into hard focus of a, what I would probably term as an elderly bloke, but rather attractive, I hate to say. I turned to Howard and I said, do you think that you as a woman, her say 70s, who promote an advert like that? And the answer is emphatically no.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, old women don't sell.
They're invisible.
This is true. This is true. Unless you're a loudmouth like Greer.
Me.
I mean, we say, don't we, in the party that, you know, there is no solution to these things inside capitalism, but that often comes over as a bit glib, and it's not going to satisfy women who want to see change now, even inside capitalism. But one way that I think that it is true is that there isn't really any answer. There isn't really any solution to this sort of this atomizing of gender identity that's taking place at the moment. Like, I feel really really sympathetic to trans people, actually, because they're rejected as men, they're rejected as women, and they're therefore non-people who are treated to levels of murder and violence that are just growing all the time, becoming simply for who they are. They're not allowed to be anybody. But I'm equally sort of sympathetic to women who feel that they're having their identity stolen away from them. There is no right answer in a situation like this, and there is no right answer within capitalism, the way that people frame their sense of identity within capitalism. I mean, and although it does seem rather glib to say it, the only thing that people can realistically say they've got in common is as members of the working class, and unfortunately that doesn't seem to be a rallying cry for people at the moment. But that's because it's not a rallying cry, that's why there's no immediate prospect of socialist revolution on the horizon.
Absolutely. But not wanting to appear hard and unfeeling, because I think everyone should be everyone, no matter if, you know, they wear a dress or whatever they want to do, should be accepted. However, when men want to be women and then they get murdered, and that's what happens to women. That is what happens to women. You know, if they think women's lives are so wonderful that they want to be women, you know, this is what happens to women. Women get murdered, they get beaten up, they get abused, they get insulted. You know, this is what upsets me. This is what part of being a woman still is. Not for every woman, but for a lot of women, this is still the case. And if they think, you know, yes, they are abused, but in the same way that women are abused. In the end, it's a class issue. Of course it's a class issue. But, you know, it's just, I will tell that to women, certain women. And I guess it brings me to the point of, you know, the whole, I think there's a proposal, well, a proposal, whatever it is, an item of discussion at a conference. Is it still an item of discussion? Can one be a feminist and a socialist?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. So that's a good one for the party to talk about.
I suppose with that, and well, with other aspects of the discussion, it's all to do with how you define terms, and no one's going to be able to come up with a catch-all definition of woman or of man or of transgender which is going to be acceptable to everyone, you know, because obviously, you know, women make up half of the just over half of the population. So, there's billions of people with, you know, their own perspective and their own framework of what these terms mean. You know, again, in recent years, the discussion has separated a bit. It's not just talking about men and women as in terms of sex, but also in terms of gender, you know, and the difference between sex and gender. So a lot of these discussions, that they're about defining terms, and added to the mix, of course, you've it's not just self-definition, it's how, you know, how men define women, how women define men, or how men define masculine, blah blah blah. So a lot of it sort of just ends up discussing or arguing about concepts, and there's only so far that discussion can go, because, you know, obviously we would say you have to move away from discussing concepts to discussing, you know, societal structures, which again, you know, that's opens up another can of worms with, you know, how you define socialism, how you define capitalism, how you define state capitalism. So yeah, there's no easy answers really when it sort of ends up as a discussion about concepts. Because you're not going to get agreement on that.
This is true, but biological sex is a fact. It's not a concept. It's not an idea in someone's head. It's a biological fact. Gender isn't. But, you know, you can't argue about biological fact.
I agree, but other people wouldn't.
But it's not a concept.
But it is a question of definition, isn't it? Because there's the question, can you be a minister and a socialist? That question is being asked the Socialist Party. But what about if the question were, be, can you be anti-racist and a socialist? Nobody would sort of dream of answering no to that question. Of course you can be. In fact, I think we have to argue you should be. So it's a question of definition. I mean, it's much clearer what we mean by anti-racist, I think, anyway, for most people. Whereas it's much less clear what we mean by feminist, and that's why the sort of controversy, if you like, with regard to feminism and its sort of relationship to socialism.
Yes, yeah.
Socialists, but you are automatically feminist.
Well, theoretically.
That's what you mean by feminism. That's the whole point that Mike was making.
I suppose it's sort of safer to say you're anti-sexist, rather than feminist. That doesn't completely solve the issue, of course, but I don't know, that could be one way around it, because yeah obviously the word feminism's got umpteen different definitions to umpteen different people. Or anti-genderist, as opposed to anti-sexist, maybe.
I just throw out a comment. I'm always confused by what women mean when they say, oh, I'm not a feminist. What does that mean?
No idea, Joy. Concept again.
Blokes.
Does anyone have an idea on that?
I think what women mean by that is they... You don't want to be identified with militancy, if you like, the kind of militancy with which feminism has become associated, something like that, I think, anyway. No doubt vague in the minds of most people who would say that, anyway.
I suppose, some women who don't identify as feminists would still say they're egalitarian, in that they, you know, oppose sexism, oppose racism, and so on. And again, you know, egalitarian, that's a safer term to use, although again, obviously you have to, you know, clarify what you mean by that. And, you know, the more you try and clarify it, the more some people will sort of pick apart at it. But yeah, that's my understanding of what women and men who don't identify as feminist would support, unless they're, of course, you know, aren't egalitarians and they're you know, misogynists or misandrists even.
So, for instance, bra burning, which never existed, by the way, has become negatively associated with feminism. And I've got a quote here, not by Germaine Greer, but by a woman called Deborah J. Cohen. She was an associate, well, probably still is, associate professor of sociology, University of Carolina. And she says, when people say, are you one of those bra burning feminists? And yes, I've been asked this many times. The people who ask this are doing so from a pre-existing place of hostility towards feminism.
Yeah, this is part of the manufactured caricature of feminism that started in the 60s, isn't it? And, you know, this is why a lot of women say that they're not feminists, because they're reacting against this caricature.
And who created that caricature, I guess? The press? Male-dominated?
However, if we take a sort of a broad historical view of the position of women in Western society, it's very different, isn't it, from what it was, let's say, 100 years ago. All sorts of ways, both small and large. I think that's the case, just as it's the case that in the last, say, 40, 50 years, the position of ethnic minorities in most Western societies is very different. You know, the ability of ethnic minorities to exist in a relatively comfortable way. For example, that's just one example. But I think if we take a broad view, I don't think we can deny that that is the case. And, obviously, that doesn't go anywhere near achieving what we'd like to achieve. You know, in that sense, that way, I think it can be said, has been some progress.
Oh, well, we can't deny that. It's progress in all sorts of things. It depends, I guess, people see it as progress or not. You know, I mean, at one point, women were washing clothes by hand on a scrubbing board and something. And now, I don't think there are very many women that don't have a washing machine at home. Yeah, that's progress, but, you know, I guess it's there are more fundamental things.
It's not just washing machines, though.
No, I know, but we don't seem to have come very fast. With class consciousness either.
Oh, that's the main thing. That's the sure thing we haven't come very far with. Yeah.
I think one thing that has changed, though, in the last couple of hundred years in more advanced countries is that women have stopped being the property of men. Legally, morally, culturally, the idea of women as property. I mean, we were talking about rape earlier on and how rape was seen as an offence against the male owner of the woman. And in fact, the etymology of the word rape comes from the Latin word to steal. Or to abduct. The Latin word for rape was something completely different, stuprum. Through the centuries, the idea of women as property has been intrinsic to to a lot of societies. And I think there's something really interesting that we've never really, well, I don't know that we've explored it very much, the idea of women as property in property society. But I think that that's something that has changed.
Well, yeah, 40 years ago, about 40 years ago, when I went and I had three children and I wanted no more. So I took it upon myself to, what they say at the time, get sterilised, which means I had my fallopian tubes clipped. But at the time, I had to get my husband's permission. So, all right, that was 40 years ago, and obviously things have changed. And in fact, some things have not changed for the better. For instance, getting back to the transgender girls and boys, pubescent children, still children, don't need their parents' permission to actually start medication. So can you imagine that?
I'm surprised if that's actually the case. I would have thought that there would be they would require at least doctor's certification for that.
No, you know the what is it called? There's the special clinic, the Tavistock Clinic, dealing with transgender children, and they don't need their parents' consent. They just need. Obviously, the doctor's there. Obviously, a consent of the doctor's there to say, yeah, we think this child is a good candidate, and we're going to put her through the process, or him through the process. Now, this is why a lot of women's groups are up in arms about this. You know, Mum's Net and everyone else are up in arms about it.
I don't know if they're the how sort of fair an analogy it is, but I think it was up until the early 70s that homosexuality was classified as a mental illness in you know, Britain and America especially, and I don't know about other European countries, and you know, things have changed, culture's changed, it's no longer considered like that, and up until fairly recently, gender dysphoria was seen as a mental illness. And I think what the current concerns are is that gender dysphoria is no longer seen as an illness, but it's seen as a condition which should be treated in a different way. And yeah, maybe it should be treated in a different way to how it was treated in previous decades. But I'm not sure how close the analogy between homosexuality and gender dysphoria is, but it's I think again it's something that the medical or most of the medical establishment is moving forward at in a direction which is faster than what research can sort of pick up on, because with anything like this, you know, gender dysphoria, you know, the long-term prognosis of someone who decides to transition, that's something that, you know, you need decades in order to fully appreciate how that's going to affect both an individual and, you know, sort of a society as a whole. So yeah, it seems if certain policies on gender dysphoria aren't sort of being shaped by science, they're being shaped by certain pressure groups or what's seen as acceptable culturally. And yeah, obviously there's a sort of a balance between the two, but yeah, I'm not sure if yet the sort of scientific research is developed enough in order to inform whatever policies should be made on conditions like gender dysphoria.
Except for, I don't think you can compare, Mike, for someone's sexual preference to being medicated for the rest of your life. And, you know, taken at puberty and being literally being medicated, because they're on medication for the rest of their life. It's not just simply, you know, have a cup, you know, a snip here and a snip there and you become a girl or you become a boy. To me, I don't think you can compare the two. I mean, one, you know, yeah, of course it's not an illness to have a sexual preference, you know, and I think my personal view would be that humans are incredibly adaptable. And that's why you have homosexuality in certain circumstances, like prisons, and you know, because it's there would be preferences, say, for a man to want to be with women rather than men. But if there are no women, then humans, you know, will find sexual pleasure and love elsewhere. I think that humans are much more adaptable to circumstances, but I don't think you can compare that with a lifelong treatment. You know, if it, when you say it's a condition, what's a condition? Isn't that a kind of illness? Isn't that a kind of, you know, if you think you know, to be, and this whole idea of someone being in the wrong body. How can you be in the wrong body? You know, you're not in the wrong body. It's to do with your mental conception, your concept, your state of mental health. Anyway, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe the analogy only goes as far as something which was once considered an illness is now considered in a slightly different way. Maybe that's as far as the analogy goes. But I suppose in terms of how homosexuality was viewed in the, you know, sort of the early part of the 20th century and maybe before, it was also seen as, you know, a male homosexual might be seen as a woman in a man's body because he's attracted to men, therefore he must be a woman, because only women are attracted to men. I think there was that sort of line of thinking. And I think, again, in a way, you know, the boundaries now between gender and sexuality with the transgender movement, they're blurred in a different way to that which society's got used to. But, yeah, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, really. But, yeah, I suppose, yeah, I think you're right. The analogy doesn't go all that far, to be honest.
And also, ideas of homosexuality have changed. I mean, in Roman times, homosexuality was perfectly acceptable. Roman soldiers took the little boys into war with them. Women would just have families with. So, you know, homosexuality hasn't always been taboo.
Well, actually, that's not quite the case, because in Roman and Greek society, it was considered a rite of passage for a young teen to be to have an older male partner, but it was a power relationship. The older partner was in a position of power and authority, and in fact, adult male homosexual relations between two adult males of equal age was considered shameful and against nature. So, in fact, it wasn't similar things. In there are similar things in Afghan culture of the 19th century. I'm not sure if it still is, but similar kind of things. So they were very much to do with power relations. So it wasn't strictly, you know, sort of egalitarian homosexual relations.
No, I wasn't suggesting it was, but I'm talking about attitudes to homosexuality. It was accepted that that's what happens. That's what.
Oh, incidentally, for something to do, I was just Googling man who wants to be a, and I was going to put in woman, but I actually got a list from Google. Man who wants to be a cat, man who wants to be a dog, man who wants to be a mermaid, man who wants to be a tiger, a parrot, an alien, and a Ken doll. And I've just quickly gone through one or two of these, and they're all real things. There really was a man who wanted to be a cat, and one who wanted to be a dog, and so forth, and a mermaid, and a tiger, and a parrot.
Yeah, it's how you want to identify. You know, it's become a joke now. You know, it's like, oh, well, I identify as whatever. I mean, it's, you know, part of it has become a joke. You can to get whatever you want, you know.
Well, parrots can talk, so do you suppose parrots would object?
I'm sure they would. How very dare they? Not everyone can be a parrot.
I think there's also been one or two people who want to identify as someone of a different ethnicity, which
that's true, yes.
Opens a big, again, that's a different sort of very sensitive can of worms, which, again, I think it only applies to a very, very small minority of people, much smaller than either the furries, I think they're called, people identify as animals. That might be something else, I'm not sure. And also, you know, people who identify as someone of the different sex or gender. There's something in culture at the moment, isn't there, about sort of identifying as what you want to be. It's easy to say, but you know, the reality is much more complicated and messy than that.
Well, yes, but there was a very famous woman, I've forgotten her name, she's still alive, that identified as being black, and the black community were horrified. Well, why can't women have the same reaction and not, you know, that was acceptable for the black community to be horrified. But for women, what, you know, we shouldn't be horrified that a man wants to identify as a woman.
What might be a good bookender for the discussion is that Germaine Greer actually wanted to be Jewish, despite being brought up a Catholic. According to Wikipedia, she believed that her grandmother had been Jewish, and there was no evidence for this, but she went out with Jewish men and joined a Jewish theatre group and learned Yiddish.
Yeah, she really liked the Jewish culture. And I have to say that when I was a teenager, the very same thing. I liked the whole Jewish culture. I read all the Isaac Bashevis Singer books. I knew a lot about Jewish culture. So, yeah, I can identify with her.